Welcome to the Voices from Afghanistan series, a five-part audio blog where we explore stories from Wisconsin veterans who served in Afghanistan from 2001 to the present. My name is Matthew Scharf. I'm joined by Rachel Halaska.
Hi.
And Tristan Krause.
Hi.
We are the summer interns for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Program. Thank you for listening.
The war in Afghanistan is the longest-standing military conflict in United States history, starting in 2001 and still going on today. In July 2016, the Obama administration capped troop levels at 8,400 service members. In June of 2017, President Donald Trump gave authority to Secretary of Defense James Mattis to reevaluate troop levels needed in Afghanistan as part of Operation Resolute Support. Given this development, we decided this was an appropriate time to look back at the historical record of this conflict.
All the segments in this series were taken from full-length interviews from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Collection. These interviews provide first-hand accounts and insights on the conflict in Afghanistan. This series will contain graphic descriptions and language that may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
This installment will cover Wisconsin veterans' experiences with combat in Afghanistan. We have incorporated stories from interviews with seven veterans ranging across military branches and occupations. These clips include firefights with Taliban insurgents, encounters with IEDs, treatment of combat injuries, and a special forces assault on a compound.
This first clip is from National Guard Finance Officer John Vandeloup, who served in Afghanistan from 2004 to 2005.
We had some contractor personnel, a small cell that we're going to begin to build this base camp kind of out in the middle of a desert, which was about two clicks straight away from us. So three of us got our battle rattle on, and we grabbed the 13 ANA that we had, because there was 13 out there. ANA, the Afghan National Army soldiers, like, you know, we call them just the ANA guys. Three of us, one guy stayed back, but three of us got battle rattled up, jumped in our pickup since like 11 o'clock at night, and we drive out there with our night vision goggles, and we don't know where we're going. It's like it's two clicks straight, but it's try to get there. It's one of these deals. Tracers flying, dismount the vehicle about 500 yards out, and we start running towards where the tracers are coming from, and the Afghans were in extremely good shape. We found that out as we went through the year. they were ahead of us, and they were going. They were going to go. They're just pure warriors. And you know, we're staying up behind them, and we end up pushing the attackers, the enemy. We pushed them back up into the mountains. There's some low mountains that came down into the valley right there. And we end up pushing them back and got the situation stabilized. But as I'm running through this desert at nighttime with my night vision goggles, and I'm trying to control these Afghan soldiers, I'm thinking, I'm a finance officer. But, you know, like they say, you know, a Marine's a Marine. Well, you know, a soldier, you know, you're supposed to know your soldier task.
Now you'll hear from three service members who have experiences with attacks on convoys and IEDs. The first is Chris Huffschmidt, a carpenter in the Army Reserves, followed by Danny Zhang, a Husky operator with a Marine Explosive Ordnance Disposal outfit, and lastly, Patrick Dahl, a Marine Heavy Equipment operator.
It was mainly held by the British, and the British just kept getting pounded all the time out there. And we, stayed there for the night, and then we made our push out there. We were going to do an all-night drive to get there, because this group we were in had a lot more night vision capabilities and were safer on the road at night than in the day. Okay. We took with us our RCP, the route clearing package. A lot of packages, a lot of kits in the Army now, which is basically a lot of vehicles that are designed to, they lead convoys out, and they're designed to find IEDs and things like that. One of the pieces on there is called a Buffalo. It's a six-wheeled vehicle, and with it comes a mechanical arm. It stretches out maybe 20, 30 feet. And you can, you know, it'll go out and it'll grab, you know, any mysterious package, stuff like that, and move it around. So if it blows up, you just replace the arm. and not, you know, two or three soldiers or a new vehicle. So we were driving out there at night, and we did a security halt. Now, a security halt is an infamously famous word for people needed to use the potty. You know, it just sounds tougher when you say security halt. So, you know, everyone's getting out and stuff like that, and we've got, you know, traffic stops forward and backwards at the end of this, like, 5-mile convoy. And it's ridiculously long. This guy didn't want to wait. He was on a motorcycle, and he wasn't going to wait. And he just said, well, I'll just go through. You know, it's like, no, idiot. At best, you go around, you know. He got shot several times. The guy couldn't wait, like, 5 minutes. You know, he had a business meeting or something. You know, but so that they wound up this 5-minute halt turns into like a 3-hour ordeal because we've now got to sit there and wait for an evac. I mean, they shot the guy up with so much morphine. You know, anything that happened to him was going to be just fine. You know, he would have never realized. He didn't make it though, but you know, we called in the chopper and stuff like that. Brought the chopper in and, you know, medevaced him out and that sort of thing. So. We get into the vehicles, finally, after the medevac's gone and so forth. And the first thing out of the out of my TC's, team captain or team commander or whatever, the guy in charge of that vehicle, was, we're going to get hit in 3 clicks. Because we have now sat there for 3 hours, and they know we're coming. And I was like, all right, wake me up, fine. You know, I've been up for now like 48 hours. I'm beat, you know. My brain is, like, somewhere else. So I'm kind of like, okay, well, when the bullets start going, I'm sure I'll hear them. Lo and behold, 5 clicks down the road, we've got RPGs coming in, we got bullets, we got everything. And it took out our Buffalo, and 3 RPGs went through the Buffalo. The way an RPG works is it's basically, like, imagine, like, just kind of a ball, but in more of a diamond-shaped thing in the beginning. And then in the back, they have the fuselage, which has all the fuel and stuff, and that's what gets the rocket to go. But also in there, it's designed to... It's like usually a rod. And the newer ones have tungsten rods in them. What happens is the warhead hits its target, and it blows it up. But the tungsten rod goes right through. So it becomes not only an explosion on there, but then it becomes this flying projectile, like a super huge bullet. So armor's not going to save you. They're not necessarily tank killers, but they're definitely ways to mess up a tank. So this little Buffalo, and they're not little, but understand they're relative to a tank, it's very small and so forth, that 3 of them went through, and they literally blew up our Buffalo, which, by the way, was on its very first maiden mission. So, of course, that was a big deal. The other reason they targeted the Buffalo is there was a bounty or ransom on them. If they could blow up Buffaloes and prove it, they'd get $500,000, $1 million, whatever it was. But, you know, there's a difference between doing it and collecting. And nobody collected. We started getting a hit. Now, the RCP package, which I was in, had 6 vehicles. Now the Buffalo is completely disabled. On fire, you know, that sort of thing. On our vehicle, I was in the 6th vehicle, so really nothing came our direction per se. We had a couple bullets bounce off the vehicles, but nothing, you know, we weren't getting the RPGs. Our 50 cal gunner, who was the gunner on the Humvee, it was a new 50 cal. And guess what happens with new 50 cals? They don't work that well. You have to cycle a lot of ammunition through them to kind of break it in. Fire, 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 you know, click. All right, redo it. Fire, 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 click. We're getting out of the vehicle then, and we're going to return fire. But I'm on the driver's side. We're getting attacked from the driver's side. So I can't really just get out. You know, I'd have to crawl through. Well, what they did is said, you know, until we can do something, you know, fire, just shoot whatever. In fact, I was, like I said, I was half out of it. I was just done. I was, like, just too tired. So I took my M16, shoved it out the window, or, you know, pulled down the windows. It was an armored Humvee and stuff, and pulled down the window and just started firing, you know. I have no night vision, because our unit didn't really have any. They had all the single eyepiece night vision things, and they could see whatever they wanted. But I did create something to kind of counter set that, and that was something called a fire mag, which is all your tracers in one magazine. You can't send too many of those. You can't send like two or three or four of them through a magazines through a weapon like that. It will just melt your barrel because they come out as magnesium. Magnesium burns extremely hot. But on all the other weapons, you know, every third or fifth round is a tracer, so you can just follow where the tracers are going. So I proceeded to, you know, just follow where the tracers were going. And then after that, it's just anything for itself. And I'm grabbing magazines left and right, And, you know, in these vehicles, that's all they do is they carry ammo. You got ammo up to wazoo. You got magazine after this and belts of, you know, ammunition and all that. And so I'm firing. I go through about five of them before our saw gunner gets out there. And it's kind of like a little version of an M60. And he just starts unloading and pouring down. So finally, we're laying down some cover such that I can crawl, you know, open the door and crawl around to the other side of the Humvee. And in that time, they proceed to, you know, we've kind of quelled whatever was there and stuff, but we're still getting a shot in here and there, and we've got a vehicle on fire. So they called back for CAS, which is combat air support. You know, that's like calling in the Apaches and so forth. And it's kind of like calling in the Green Bay Packers to beat up the 9-year-old bully. You know, it's really one-sided. CAS came in, and there's nothing more impressive than watching Hellfire missiles just rain down. And that's what they did, you know, because they have heat and all these things, all these sensors and infrared and all this stuff on these Apache helicopters. And they were like, oh, yeah, there you are, you know. Boom, 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 you know. They had a guy who actually went down a well, like a 50-foot well, and they proceeded to just bury him. There's an old saying in the world, I'm never afraid of a policeman's badge or his gun or his stick. I'm afraid of the radio that's going to call the 50 other guys with guns, badges, and sticks. So that's kind of the way this works. You know, you guys can take your pot shots, but, you know, absolutely zero injuries, zero casualties except for our beloved Buffalo, which we no longer had, which they delivered one to us next day and said, don't break it this time.
The first time rocked me pretty good. We were just on a normal patrol. We patrolled a different route that day. I remember pulling up to a little water pump, and I saw rocks like an indicator along the road, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, there's indicators there, there's markings on the buildings, everything else like that. All the signs are there. And you're like, all right, well, now it's just, where is it? So when you're looking for it, it's kind of tough because, like, whatever you see in front of your vehicle, that's 5 foot away or in front of your vehicle. Because when you look down at it, the only time you can actually get a really good look is when you're pulled up right next beside it and you're marking that spot so that way the buffalo could come up and do its thing. Or else EOD could dismount and they could go look for it. But then the thing about EOD dismounting or anybody dismounting at all is that you could get into an ambush. Because sometimes that's what they did too. Like, they would just put markings there so that way you dismount and they would just ambush you. And then that's worse when you have men on the ground and you're in a firefight. You know, you really have to be careful then. So the first time I went up to it and I knew the indicators were there, but we're always told, you know, if it's a resource that they need, they wouldn't blow it up because it's hard to get that resource from them. And in that case, it was a water generator where it was just pumping the water out of the ground and going into the river. So you would think that they're not going to blow that up. And when I went up to it, you know, I was inspecting. I didn't see any wires coming out of it or anything, so I didn't see anything. So as I was looking right at it, you know, I had my panels down, scanning everything. I didn't detect anything, so that was the weird part. And plus, it's right next to a generator, so it throws off all of our equipment. And then my rear tire clipped the pressure plate. So then the IED went off right behind my back bumper, which forced my vehicle forward. The only thing that happened to my vehicle is my mirrors blew out. But the thing about it, too, is that, like, you're so close to it, and when it goes off, you don't have any ear protection or anything, because you have to listen to your equipment when it's going off and everything so you could understand what you need to do. So when it went off, it just went off right behind me. And then I was pretty dazed. It forced my vehicle forward. And that was it. But then this was really stupid on my part, because, you know, when I was just like, all right, well, I'm okay, you know. The only thing that happened is just my mirrors blew out. I should be fine. But when we got back, I decided to continue with the mission. So then instead of being the lead Husky, I became the second Husky. But then they threw me in the back of the, you know, or in the middle of the convoy, because I didn't have an up gun. So the only weapon system I had on me was my 9mm. So as we were going to finish the route, you know, we got back. I got checked by our corpsman, and then he's like, all right, dude, I think you need to go to the hospital with me. You know, I got to run some tests on you. And it comes back that, like, I had, like, a class 2 concussion. So I was like, okay, well, you know, did this happen to you? I'm like, yes. Did you feel this? So, it's just, you know, one of those things where it's just, like, you think you could continue going, but then, like, after that incident, then you realized. Because, like, what the IED does is, right, the initial explosion actually contracts your spine going up and down. So all those little, like, your vertebrae, it expands, and then when you come down, or, like, when your vehicle comes down, it all just crunches back up again. So they were like, well, you got to get that checked and everything else. So that was the first time it happened. The second time, I believe there was a string that was running off to my left side by the canal. Because on my right side there was a canal, and on my left side there was like a little trenched canal that they did. And I didn't see it, but, you know, like, you can't clean your mirrors, you know. So that was one of the different IEDs where they had a battery source to it. And all they had to do was connect the wires to the battery and it would go off. So there was no pressure plates. And it was, the way they did it was very smart. There was a hole in their wall that ran into the battery source, so they could just slip through that hole and see us where we're at and blow us up and run away. So that's the second time that happened to me. And then after that, we were on our way back. So it was pretty interesting. And then after that, I went to the hospital with my corpsman. They were like, yeah, you have class 1. So after that, they were just like, well, if you already had 2 concussions, we don't want you to have another one, because then you're really not going to be able to come out with us no more. And that was one of the things, like, when you get hurt, or for me it was, when I got hurt, I didn't want to stay away from my platoon, because you worry about your guys, you know, and you worry about everybody, but then, like, you have a stronger feeling towards the guys that you came there with, the guys in your platoon. You know, like, you ate with them every day. You did everything with them every day. So that camaraderie and that brotherhood, you didn't want anything to happen to them without you being there with them. You know, so if anything happens, at least you were there and you could help them out or back them up or something. So, yeah, we were going back to the main FOB, and that's what happened. And after that, they just said, hey, you're going to be the gunner for the medevac vehicle. So that was my primary mission for the rest of the deployment. So probably like around maybe 4 months.
November 27th at 16:30 on 2010. we were driving from Camp Royer going up to Leatherneck to do a run, taking them supplies, you know, so they could keep doing their thing up there. Coming through a valley, coming through a wadi, basically were in the, they fill it with water during the rainy season, but this was a big one, probably about a couple hundred yards wide, and came down through there, and it was pretty, not treacherous, but, you know, we had to, each way, we would find kind of a different way to go, and coming through these, there was a lot of mountains around, and but we came through and I saw the same white car that we had seen the last time. So I was kind of like, oh, I didn't mean to go this way. But sometimes you just get canalized into the way you're going. And we were looking up, me and my driver and the gunner. We were trying to find a good spot. And that's where we hit the IED. And we had, everyone was, our gunner got knocked out. Driver was pretty good. I got a concussion, a grade 2 concussion. We called up, we got, you know, it actually went pretty smooth, and we practiced. It was, you know, I've been practicing for 8 years, it felt like, for that one time. But, you know, we got out, you know, we got the truck out, we moved it. We had the mine roller on it, it sticks out about, the car's about 8 feet, wheels on it, sticks out in front of the truck for just that purpose. You know, I think that saved us about a, saved us. It was, I think they estimated it was like 60 or 70 pounds of HME, homemade explosive. So, you know, it was a pretty good size boom. But
you know, and this roller that's on the front of the truck is what set
it Yeah, up. It was a pressure plate IED that they didn't. It was pretty much, they didn't offset it. Sometimes they've been, one of their tactics was to, you know, you put the pressure plate and then move the explosives back, you know, 10 feet, so that way when you hit it, it's actually underneath the truck if you have the mine roller. But they didn't do that, so we were fortunate for that. So we got our, you know, it took a, did a pretty good number on it. But yeah, so that was, it wasn't my last convoy, but, you know, so they took us, we had to stay at the concussion clinic, and they've come a long way since my first appointment of, you know, treating people. Like, if that would have been in 2005, they would have just been like, all right, you're fine. No one ever thought anything of it, so they did have very good treatment of us. But so we were lucky, man. The gunner was the only one that he got knocked out, but he had no serious injuries. So that, and the truck we were in, all the armor on it was just mostly the blast is what got us inside. So after that, I ended up kind of put on a desk job.
Next, Robert Warren, a Marine with multiple combat tours in Afghanistan, discusses combat operations while in a firefight with the Taliban.
Air support was sketchy. Sometimes we could get it, sometimes we were just too high up and the helicopters just couldn't fly there.
What sort of helicopters are we talking about?
Apaches and Cobras, the AH-64 and the UH-1. The UH-1s really couldn't keep up. The Apaches kind of could. But, yeah, it was almost like a throwback in time, because there was a lot of times where all you had was your rifle and everything that you owned was on your back, and you were walking miles and miles, oh, really for months and months, and stop. Every time you'd get engaged, you'd drop your pack and go chase down the Taliban wherever they were at, up in the hills, or if we're doing offensive operations, wherever they identify a Taliban stronghold, the same thing. We'd march to our staging area or our assembly areas and take your pack if you want to, or drop it there, and they'd leave a guard on them and conduct whatever we had to do there. One of my squads was... they were gaining the upper hand in a firefight, but our company commander wanted more out there, so launched the QRF. We went out there, got on the flank of the Taliban, rolled up their flank. Things were going great. Then you saw a guy with an RPG pop up, and he was oriented towards my 240, my medium machine gun. So I shot him, and then I shifted to the guy next to him. The guy next to him shot before I did. I didn't feel it. I just heard a wet slapping sound, and I tried to shoot the guy, and nothing happened. And my rifle didn't fire, no recoil. My first thought was, okay, I got a malfunction. Something's wrong with my M4. And I looked down, and my M4 was good, and I saw a hole in my sleeve. And I still remember saying it. I looked at the Marine next to me, and I said, hey, that was close. And then he looked over, and he saw blood, and he said, that wasn't close. He hit you. And I looked at my arm, and I thought, oh, hell, okay. So I had that kid come over and wrap a bandage around my forearm. And the whole time, so that he could wrap up my arm, I was standing up. And I was still directing fire team leaders and my machine gun and still fighting the enemy while the other squad was pushing south. So I'm having to shut off different people's fires as that squad was pushing south. Meanwhile, I got some lance corporal wrapping up my arm because our corpsman's we didn't have my platoon corpsman. We had the company corpsman. So we ended up finishing up the firefight. I looked at the squad leader for the QRF, and I said, hey, you need to call this in. So he called it in, and I was standing there, and I had my radio, so I was listening. And my first sergeant came over to the hook. He was like, hey, is that the platoon sergeant? Is that his zap code? Is he the one that got shot? The zap code is your first and last initial, last four, and blood type. I got on radio. I said, yeah, I got shot in the arm. So, oh, okay, hold on. I'm not sure if we're going to medevac you. And I don't know why, but that pissed me off, and it made me madder than it really should have. So I got on my radio, and I said, all right, well, I'm walking back. You better have a medevac waiting for me when I get there. And I didn't realize how badly I was hit at the time, between dehydration, shock, and blood loss, really. So I walked back to the combat outpost and just bleeding like a stuck pig the whole way. And walked in, and my first sergeant was standing there, and I still remember the look of just terror on his face. I was covered in blood, and from the neck up, I was white as a sheet. But I was still walking, I was still talking. So he came over, and he took my rifle away from me and grabbed me by the arm and drugged me into the company aid station. And the independent duty corpsman we had there, he looked at me like he cut the bandage off my arm, and my arm basically just fell apart. And he just started screaming, urgent surgical, urgent surgical, urgent surgical. And I just sat there. I was, I don't know, still didn't really feel anything. I was looking at the bones in my arm thinking that's not good, but wasn't really worried, wasn't. Just kind of, okay. Helicopter came, picked me up. They told me I had to lay. I remember arguing with the medic in the back. He told me I had to lay down on the stretcher. I had already sat down in the back seat and buckled myself in, and I'm good, just go. And he got nose to nose with me and said, this helicopter is not leaving the ground until you're on the stretcher. And I vividly remember looking him in the eye saying, you're in a loud helicopter on the ground in Marja. I'm comfortable. How about you? Because at that point, helicopters normally wouldn't even fly over Marja during the day. The dust-off guys would come in, but other than that, helos wouldn't come around. So he stopped, and he said something in his headset, and off it went. Got to the hospital. They brought me in. I remember a specialist was trying. She was going to cut my boots off, and I'd already decided that I was going to go. I was going back to my platoon. So when she said something about cutting my boots off, I took my boots off before she could come back with the trauma shears. And her and the nurse, why'd you take your boots off? We could have just cut them off. And I remember saying, do you have any idea how hard it is to get a 10 regular in this country? And they were said, well, you may not be going back. And I'm going back. So I spent about a week in the hospital, went back to my platoon. Nothing had changed. I was able to keep track of casualties because they were all coming to the same hospital as me. Out of the 10 beds in the ward, 8 of them were guys from my platoon. Almost all of them were able to go back to the platoon, though. So we got back to the platoon. My battalion commander told me I wasn't allowed to leave the wire for 5 days. The 6th day, we went out to an A&A position, and nothing happened while we were at the A&A position. As we were walking back, took fire and got told to go to stop in an area that we knew was bad. It was very little cover, historic fighting positions. The company ordered us to stay put, so we did, and we eventually started taking fire. I had one of my machine gunners get shot, and the rest of that fire team was just in a bad place. Only one guy had been shot, but it was a matter of time before somebody else got shot. I was with the lead element, the lead fire team. I told the team leader to take the bulk of that fire team, link up with the squad as best they can. And I was going to take the point man with me, and we were going to try to get around to the flank of the Taliban. I didn't intend on rolling up their flank. I just wanted to get them to break contact so we could get a helicopter in. We were in a perfect position. We were looking down the long axis of their whole ambush. So we started engaging them. Ended up the two of us taking out about a squad of Taliban. Link back up with the squad. Company decides to start asking questions, basically trying to debrief us while we're still in the field. Patrol back. Link up with company commander, company first sergeant. Basically talking over what had just happened. Then I got in trouble for, well, not really in trouble, but I got the don't do that again speech for, it wasn't my plan, but the opportunity presented itself, so we took it.
In this segment, John McNally, a Special Forces team commander, describes tracking the Taliban, gathering intelligence, and assaulting a compound.
And then in typical Army fashion, we were told to go down into the Gardezi area and be prepared for a 5-day mission, which eventually converted into a 4 or 5 week mission. So part of our job down there was to work with Navy SEALs, SEAL Team 6, their dev group, who were doing more of the direct action stuff. And in my personal opinion, the SEALs are over there just because everyone wants to get their fingers in the pot. They're excellent in the water. That's their job, but on the ground, away from water, their small unit tactics and their TTPs are somewhat wanting. But because they have better priority and a higher up on the pecking order, so we were working with them initially. And unfortunately, you can't go through the same routine. And I discussed this with their commander because we were helping to secure compounds while they were going in. And since they have a lot of the resources, they were able to get a lot of the radio direction finding and figure out where the bad guys were. And so we would help them help secure the compounds and catch the bad guys, or what they thought were bad guys. But the problem was they set up a routine that they would go out right around dusk in trucks, and everyone knew who they were, and then they would come back into the compound around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. You do that a couple times using the same routes, bad guys pick up on that pretty fast. And so, unfortunately, as a result, they had a couple other guys ambushed, and one guy was killed. But what this leads into is the medevac. They call for a medevac, or we call for a medevac through the regular Army channels. And the helicopter for that was one mountain range over, about 20 or 30 miles. But the problem is they don't spin up when they hear somebody in contact. They wait until someone verifies and calls them instead of being a little more proactive. And they were telling us it'd take about an hour or more for them to get a medevac. And so the SEALs, through their resources and the CIA that were over there, called up a medevac from 3 times a distance away, who, when they had heard about the firefight, had already started spinning up. Uh-huh. And so they were on the ground, had picked up the guys that were injured, and they were gone from 3 times the distance before the guys that we called had come over and touched down. But when they touched down, our side, the regular Army medevac, they were mad at us saying, you know, you called us. Well, you know, you're going to, you see the dilemma. You try to work your own channels, and no one, unfortunately, they are, a lot of people sit back and they aren't proactive. But another good aspect of that mission was after we finished working with the SEALs in that Zormatt Valley, my team started working, just trying to piece together who are the guys that ambushed them. And we had a radio direction finding team with us, SOD A's. And so we started, it takes patience. You know, the guys on the team, they don't necessarily always like to be patient. They want to go in and they want action all the time. So part of my job was to say, hey, you know, we need to develop this a little bit. And so that's what we started doing with the SOD A's. We would, because they were expecting Americans to come in on vehicles, because that's all they had seen, I told the guys we need to do something different. And so we came in, this area that had been getting a lot of radio activity, we came in, well, over a period of 2 weeks, we've been getting a lot of hits, I guess, of radios. And so we came in with the translator from the east side, and we settled in right before dark. And so everyone could see, you know, hey, this is where we're at. And we're attached to our vehicles, or so they thought. And I sent four of my guys, we did split team, on foot at night. There was no moon. And they went in 4 miles amongst the compounds to the area that we thought that these guys were talking. And they were up on the radio net that night. And it turns out that the way he was talking, that this guy was the main ringleader for this whole valley. And they were directing the teams, the ambushes against people. The unfortunate thing with that night was, you know, you can't get a pinpoint location on a radio if you only have one interceptor. Right. So, and we weren't able to get the overhead airplane that night. Yeah. And normally they can give you a 10-digit grid. For that night, the resources weren't there. We only had ourselves on the ground. Yeah. So we couldn't give the guys on the ground, hey, we need to go nab this guy. We knew the way he was talking that he was out in the field. He had a big dog. The guys on the ground who were up there said that they saw a guy in the field on the ground. But we, you know, just
a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they didn't know we were there. So I said, guys, you know, just it's not worth compromising the fact that we know that they're in the area right now if we're not 100% sure that we're going to get them.
Yeah.
Right. So I pulled them off that night, and they came back right before dawn. And we said, we'll attack it later. And so we went back to the compound we were staying at in Gardez, and we refitted. And 2 days later, we came back. But only from, we were now positioned ourselves north of the same compound, about 3 to 4 miles.
This guy hasn't moved.
This guy hasn't. Well, we don't think he's moved. I mean, he moves around. From the pattern that he was establishing himself, there were certain days that 75%, we were 75% sure that he was going to be at this compound area. And we set ourselves off 3 or 4 miles again that night. So dusk comes, there's almost zero moon illumination, which is good. You know, the guys can't see us, and we've got night vision goggles. And so I sent the guys in again. Same 4 guys. They've been on the terrain before. They knew it. They knew what they were looking for. And sent them in at night from about three or four miles away. And the plan was, well, that night we did have the airplane overhead. So, and the guy did come up again that night. And they usually operated in a window between 9 p.m. and midnight, or 9 p.m. at 1 o'clock in the morning. They wouldn't operate any other time other than that. And as luck would have it, or not, that night my new battalion commander had gotten intelligence of a lot of activity going on 15 miles south of us. But he ordered all these teams to flood the area. So now we have a bunch of Americans coming down these three main roads, and who should come up but our guy in this compound is ordering ambushes against our guys. He's got eyes out there. He can see their headlights. So now he's ordering ambush against them. And we're 3 miles away picking this up.
So, right in the middle, aren't
you? So we're right in the middle. My battalion commander is trying to tell me, you need to move south 15 miles and join the teams. And I told him, no, you know, we're picking this up. They're staging ambushes against the guys that are coming down right now. Uh-huh. And once he realized that the information I was getting, he goes, okay, you guys stay in place and you continue to work that. But he was coming up really strong, and we knew he was in that area. And what was pretty neat was they didn't know that I had 4 guys on the ground, on foot, right outside their compound. They were clueless because they thought we were in these vehicles 3 or 4 miles north of them.
That's the only Americans in the area.
Right.
Yeah.
So I made the decision that as the window was closing, that we would drive up and take the compound. And this compound ended up being a little bit bigger than what I would have liked. There were mud walls, you know, 3 and 4 feet thick. They're huge.
Wow.
And inside these compounds, you'd have, you know, 7 to 10 families all in these mud huts, and everything's connected. The doors are maybe 4 or 5 feet high, and they're super skinny. They're very convoluted once you get into them. It's a maze. So we drove down in the vehicles now. I've got half the team. We're driving the vehicles, and I positioned the vehicles on the north side of this compound, and the four guys that I had on the ground, they moved around to the south to seal it off from the south. And they get, as we're coming up from the north, you know, they're outside the door of the compound, and three guys try to sneak out the back. So my guys nabbed them right away. And we know one guy got away that we should have gotten, but he snuck in because he knew all sorts of little back alleys and stuff, and he snuck through.
Lisa Kromenacher, a Nurse Corps officer with the Navy Reserves, served in the medical surgical ward of the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. In this audio excerpt, she discusses treating wounded soldiers from both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Generally, if they were coming from the combat zone, their average length of stay would be about 3 to 5 days because we were kind of that stopping point. They'd stabilize them in the field, in the surgical hospitals in the field, come to us to maybe get what we call the washout, which is a debridement. They open up the wounds and re-spray them down with saline at a high power, close them back up, you know, check for any dying tissue, take it out, seal them back up, and then we'd watch them for infection, give them pain medicines and antibiotics, and then send them on to Andrews Air Force Base on a flight, you know, a few days later. So, and then from there, they'd either stay at Walter Reed or Bethesda Naval Medical Center, depending on their branch of service, or maybe if they were a burn victim, they would all go to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. And if they were less severely injured but needed a long-term recovery or long-term rehab, we try to get them to a hospital closest to their home station. If they were active duty, it was their home base. If they were a reservist that had been mobilized and deployed, then we would get them to their home state and have them recover there, or the closest VA to take care of them.
Can you talk a little bit about the types of injuries that you saw, you know?
Sure.
Kind of coming to you?
Unfortunately, a lot of amputations. The worst one I saw was a triple amputee. And ironically, the amputees had the best attitudes. It was really amazing. And I'm not sure, I think it might have a lot to do with the fact that they probably are just grateful that they are alive and they've made it that far. And we're not at the point where they're in their rehab and trying to face reality for the rest of their life. So, but it was amazingly refreshing to see that. It was just mind-boggling, you know, when you think they'd just be depressed. Some collapsed lungs where they had put a tube in their chest to reinflate the lung. Abdominal injuries where they'd have to open up their abdomen and operate on their intestines. A lot of soft tissue injury from shrapnel and, you know, weapons and a lot of IEDs. And then we started seeing, forget the name of the newest one they came up with, that was the melting, I don't remember that there's a weapon they came up with that was not an IED, but it would create this melting metal, would basically melt the bottom of a bulletproof a Humvee.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we started seeing a lot of lower body injuries. So they would have these, what we call wound vacs on them to clean out the areas. They wouldn't always close up the wounds right away, either in the field or even in our hospital. And they would put these vacuums on their wounds to basically suck out any of the drainage and blood that's occurring so that the tissue underneath could heal and not be pocketed with fluids. So they would have to keep those on until they would sew them back up. Then they could fly. Otherwise, they couldn't fly, obviously, with a vacuum on them. But a lot of, I think, most of the patients that were coming to the hospital were psychiatric patients. I know that one of the statistics I read that about 80% of our veterans from these wars are having PTSD, and Launchtool started a traumatic brain injury screening program, and they found that about 33% of the warriors are coming back with traumatic brain injury, any sort of concussion or loud noise or loud impact near the head or brain just jostles it all up, and they lose memory or change of emotions, or and it's causing a lot of problems back home. And I think that's what our VAs are going to be dealing with for a long time.
If you or someone you know is interested in donating materials or taking part in a veteran interview, please contact the museum. If you enjoyed listening to this installment, be on the lookout for additional installments in the Voices from Afghanistan series. Thanks for listening.